In your first interview with 12th Pier, just over a year ago, October 2016, seems like a lifetime ago now, I asked you a question that was popular at the time regarding parallels between the Reagan candidacy and the Trump candidacy, and you correctly and outrightly said there were no parallels to be drawn. Are there now parallels between the Reagan presidency and the Trump presidency?
And at this point, I'm going to reverse what I said previously. You're quite right. I was very dismissive of people trying to draw, again, mainly from this continent, a simplistic parallel between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump. Say what you will about Ronald Reagan, he had been governor of California for two terms, which is no small achievement. Donald Trump, of course, has become America's first president never to have served in the military or held political office beforehand. However, just as Donald Trump has come to office and has caused great outrage around the world and consternation here in Europe by what he has said and done, so too, it must be remembered, did Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan came to office, the very, very first complete day of his presidency, he walked into the press briefing room, scene of so many recent encounters with Sean Spicer and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and President Reagan outright attacked the Soviet Union, the nation which, if I'm paraphrasing, said Reagan said, you know, reserved to themselves the right to lie, to cheat, to steal, and to commit any crime in the defense and advancement of its own ideology. He went on later to talk about them and describe them as an evil empire. With his language and a philosophy which in many ways was a pushback to the 1950s. You know, you counter that with what John F. Kennedy had said in the last summer of his life at American University in 1963, when Kennedy had basically said that no people should be considered to lack moral integrity because of the system of their government. You know, he was clearly talking about a rapprochement with the Soviet Union. You know, in 63 and 20 years later on, effectively, Ronald Reagan's talking about an evil empire. So, you know, there was a sense with Reagan that this was a pushback to an earlier era of Cold War rhetoric. And we can, I think, see that with Donald Trump nowadays, you know, the way he talks about North Korea in particular and his rather cavalier attitude towards public diplomacy and how that's been received both in the US in some parts, in some quarters, in Asia, and certainly here in Europe. I think we can see a parallel with Reagan. Let me see if I can be generous, since it's far too simple to be just a critique of Donald Trump, and I think we are seeing the unfortunate rise of professional Trump critics.
Absolutely.
It's far too simplistic. I would never have voted for him, but let's just bear this out for a second. Reagan was seen to have been this caricature of himself almost when he becomes president. And yet 8 years later, we find him walking through Red Square with his new friend, Mikhail Gorbachev, categorically stating, when asked about the evil empire, saying, no, I don't believe that anymore. That was a different place in a different time. Reagan is credited amongst his Republican supporters as being the president that brings about the end of the Cold War. And whilst that conclusion can be, you know, rightly questioned, he played an important part in bringing about the end of hostilities and lowering tensions eventually with the Soviet Union. Does that come about because of Ronald Reagan's sort of fiery Cold War rhetoric or because of the rapid demise of an entire generation of Soviet leadership, including Brezhnev, Andropov, and Chernyenko, leading to the young premiership of Mikhail Gorbachev? I think it's more likely that it was the fact that Gorbachev and Reagan recognized in one another the fact that both leaders were willing to compromise and sit down and talk and respect one another, something which we hadn't seen happen for several generations, if ever, between the US and the USSR. So ultimately, that means that there needs to be, I think, potentially new leadership emerging in Korea, which is unlikely at this point. So, you know, we will have to see how history bears out for the Trump presidency, if it does indeed manage to last for 8 years. But certainly, one would be looking for growth in Trump in office, which, it must be said, in the first 9 months has yet to materialize.
Something that's materializing before our very eyes here, even as we're recording this show, Lieutenant General McMaster has said words to the effect that America doesn't have much time left to prevent a war with North Korea. Kim Jong-un's latest long-range missile test is believed to have put the US mainland within range. I've heard you elaborate in the past on lessons Trump might learn from the Cuban Missile Crisis to improve his approach to the present cold engagement with North Korea. What are those lessons?
I mean, fundamentally, the lessons of the missile crisis that Kennedy learned from the Bay of Pigs in 62 were to always empathize with your opponent, to try to understand why your opponent was doing what it was that he was doing, to put yourself in their shoes and to try and see how the crisis looked from their position, to never draw red lines to put either yourself in a corner or your opponent in a corner, to recognize that it's eminently possible that what appears to be the crisis at hand is merely a diversionary tactic, and that the bigger picture reveals that the great crisis is actually somewhere else. In 1962, everybody was focused upon Cuba, but JFK's great concern was that it was a pretext for a move into Berlin. And that would have potentially triggered a European theater of war operations because of US commitments through NATO to Berlin that could easily have escalated to nuclear war. We're clearly in a different era at this point, but quite frankly, you know, if one is to look at what's going on in Korea at the moment, it's difficult to see how Trump is learning anything from the missile crisis. One does not see any attempt to appreciate the position that that North Korea is in, to appreciate why it might be doing what it's doing. No attempt to utilize diplomacy. No attempt to figure out, well, is there a bigger picture at stake here? Donald Trump appears to be personalizing this to an extent which is not only inappropriate but unhelpful and both cavalier and dangerous. There is, I think, a risk of giving the Korean leadership far too much stature by dealing with the North Korean leadership on a one-to-one basis through Twitter. I think that Donald Trump is perhaps unaware of what he is doing in terms of elevating the leadership of that country to the same level as the United States. You know, there is an old adage which is, you know, don't get in a fight with a pig, they'll drag you down to their level and get you covered in mud, to put it politely. And that is the risk that Donald Trump is running at this point, I think. He is unnecessarily ramping up the situation. He talks about the end of, you know, the Obama era sense of policy towards Korea. That had been a bipartisan policy, it must be said, stretching back several decades and several administrations. You know, Donald Trump talks about this end of an era as though it's something he is, you know, sort of concocted himself to you know, as a straw man to collapse it. The problem is, you know, you need a policy and a strategy to replace it with. And at this point, there doesn't appear to be one other than just belligerence. Strategic patience, which is the policy that Donald Trump talks about ending, is not perfect, but then few policies in diplomacy are, and Donald Trump is not well versed enough yet in diplomacy to appreciate the fact that, you know, unfortunately, all too few diplomatic solutions are perfect. There are winners, there are losers, and if you take a winner-take-all approach to diplomacy, you're going to be disappointed most of the time.
We recorded the first episode of the American Chronicle in January of this year at the Trump Symposium at Richmond that you so masterfully put together. You ended that symposium, and indeed the first show, with the words, "What if it works? What if the post-World War II consensus has failed and the Trump way was the answer? What if President Trump could bring about genuine change for the better?" We're just 1 year on from Trump's election. Do you still find any resonance in that original question?
It's great getting your own words thrown back at you like that. It's interesting. I'd forgotten I'd said that. It was more about trying to put something forward, which I thought wasn't being floated at that point. The challenge is this. As long as everybody seems to want Trump to fail, we all lose. What does Trump's failure look like? I mean, ultimately, a Trump failure could be catastrophic, not only for the American people, but for the globe.
Absolutely.
You know, it's something which people are not thinking about.
Highly subjective, obviously, but what might a Trump success look like at this stage, domestically?
Let's imagine that he succeeds in making America great again by reducing taxation levels that make American business level rate tax the lowest in the world and becomes a very attractive place for American businesses and global businesses to do business again. Could that lead to an influx of capital and investment into the US? Possibly. If that was continued to lower income rates, income tax in the United States, and so that all Americans end up paying lower rates of income tax, he would no doubt become very, very popular as a result of that. And I would imagine you would see attempts to implement that on a global basis. You know, I fundamentally believe that what happens in the US very quickly catches on around the world. So if Trump were to lower business rates in the US, I'd imagine there'd be push in Great Britain very, very quickly from the likes of Liam Fox, for example, to introduce something very similar here to reduce business rate tax on the basis that if we don't, businesses based in the UK will look to move across the pond. We've got to be competitive. Same with income tax. If income tax levels were reduced in the US, I think there would be a push here from the Conservative Party to talk about introducing that at a party-wide level in any future manifesto. What else could Trump do? Well, one of the first things he talked about as president-elect was having a massive infrastructure spending plan to rebuild, literally, America's crumbling infrastructure. He's getting no joy from that from the Republicans, who fundamentally do not believe in governmental spending for such projects. But he would find great traction, I'm quite sure, amongst Democrats. Now, if Democrats were to regain the House and the Senate, which is not impossible in the midterm elections of 2018, then Trump could very easily realign himself and work with Democrats, I think, to get such a package through both houses of Congress. And that would have a huge impact if that sort of a physical rebuilding of the United States were to occur moving into the 2020 era. Frankly, the country is in dire need of an infrastructure rebuilding program. And if Trump could achieve that, then that would be to the betterment of the entire country. All these things, it must be said, are dependent entirely upon Donald Trump rising to the occasion and presiding as president of the United States and not simply being the Breitbart candidate for president and maintaining levels of support hovering around 33% to 35%. As long as that is the case, his ability to get anything done, be it with a Republican or a Democrat Congress, is minimal. So we have to wait and see.
On the same question, what if it works, but in the realm of foreign policy?
Well, the problem that Trump's got in terms of that is, what does that look like? Because all he has done so far with regard to foreign policy, in my opinion, is to be the retrenchment president. You know, we saw this happening under Obama, of course, pulling back from American overseas engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that, it must be said, had already begun under George W. Bush, who had started that process before he left office vis-a-vis Iraq. So a scaling back of American overseas entanglements is not anything that we can look to Donald Trump as being the instigator of, but merely the perpetuator of. On the other hand, he's clearly getting America's saber rattling in place in places like North Korea. He is clearly agitating the Iranian leadership. He looks like he is scaling back the American commitment vis-a-vis Cuba that Obama had instigated. You know, some of these initiatives had been put in place in by the United States under Barack Obama in his last term in office, which were particularly contentious. The nuclear deal with Iran. Obama knew he couldn't get that as a treaty through Congress, so he signs an executive decision. Same thing with Cuba. It must be pointed out, something which most people aren't giving a lot of thought to. You know, the question must be asked, to what extent did these implications, these decisions, have a knock-on effect for the 2016 election? You know, if you don't have the Cuban deal, for example, does that make Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party a much more attractive candidate to Republican, to members of the Cuban community in Florida? Does Hillary lose Florida if you don't have the Cuban deal? You know, the extent to which foreign policy impacts domestic policy and domestic policy impacts foreign policy is something which I think, you know, most people who know my work will recognize as being central to how I try to study and approach these issues. But I think it's something which is given far too little attention generally. And certainly it's going to be interesting to see how it is that Donald Trump's foreign policy impacts domestic politics in the US, not least of all with regard to his own political standing and capacity to win re-election in 2020.
Our final question for tonight, then, to bring us full circle. Of the many people I've spoken to, much hope is presently placed on a poor showing for Republicans in next year's midterm elections, with the obvious purpose of destabilizing Trump and maybe bringing about the kind of forced primary scenario that we discussed at the top of this show. But what are the negatives when campaigning leaders take priority over functioning administrations in this constant world of election and re-elections in the West?
Donald Trump's re-election campaign officially began the first day in office. Remarkably, it must be said. The problem with this is that it just reinforces something I've said in a number of places and a number of classes, which is the American political system is beautifully geared up for campaigning, less well for governing. And as long as you have politicians whose sole ambition and sole focus is gaining and regaining and retaining office, there's very little scope for compromise that's required to get serious legislation through. How do you devise strategy, least of all grand strategy, you know, when you've got, you know, everybody looking at the clock and thinking, well, I've got to be reelected in less than 2 years if you're in the Congress, less than 4 years if you're in the presidency, and less than 6 years if you're in the Senate. How do you think about a long-term game? You know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about the rise of China. You know, the Chinese leadership is not thinking, I've got to be re-elected in 2 years' time. They are playing the long game, as is Vladimir Putin, it must be said, I think, in Russia. And the political structures in both China and Russia, but particularly in China, give them a huge advantage strategically, I think, over the United States, which it's difficult to understand how that can be assuaged when you look at the short-term domestic implications of the American political calendar and the impact that that has upon the ability to implement and execute strategy, both domestically and foreign policy-wise, to the detriment of all concerned.
That's it for this episode of The American Chronicle, a 12th Peer Productions program 2017, with music by Chris Warner.